welcome to this week's episode of Military History Inside Out. This week I speak with historian Dr. Grant Madsen, who's written Sovereign Soldiers. It's about how the U.S. military transformed the global economy after World War II by their activities while they occupied Germany and Japan. The book actually also goes further back in time and talks about some of the U.S. military efforts in governing territories they took after the Spanish-American War. And then the book also goes forward after the occupation period into Eisenhower's administration and discusses his approach to the economy and how the military fits into economic policy and that sort of thing. So a lot of very interesting discussions about economic history as it relates to war and the military and the sort of policies that the U.S. military tried to follow to help revitalize Germany and Japan, and also the strategic policy the U.S. had in mind when it did revitalize those two nations. So, very interesting discussion, and I hope you enjoy. Thank you. I'm speaking with Grant Madsen, author of Sovereign Soldiers, How the U.S. Military Transformed the Global Economy After World War II. Thank you for speaking with me.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be talking with you.
So tell me, how did you get into history and writing about history?
Wow, those are really big questions. But I think I'll start with the first part, and that is how to get into history. Well, there are a lot of answers. I think part of it is, it turns out, I kind of grew up with both my mom is a PhD in history also, and so I kind of grew up with history in the home. But she studied 19th century women's history, and so that was a little bit outside of my immediate interest, even though I think it's fascinating in its own way. I think that's part of the answer, but I think the closer, the better answer is that as time passed, I realized that I just sort of made sense of the world historically. That, you know, like when I encountered problems, my first question was always, well, where did this problem come from? Mm-hmm. You know, or if I was ever, you know, stuck in a situation or, you know, whether it's in jobs or school or whatever else, anytime there was some kind of an intellectual challenge, my instinct was always to say, well, what happened before this that created this question or created this thing? And when I kind of came to realize that about myself, it just seemed to make sense to eventually get into the world of history. And so that's what eventually led me to a PhD program, and that's what eventually led me to writing this book, because as you probably know, and your listeners probably know, one of the challenges of the PhD is you have to write a dissertation, and that has to be a piece of original research. And for me, I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to work on, but I kind of knew I wanted to work on something having to do with the middle part of the 20th century, and I wanted it to be a little bit about politics, and I thought that it would be interesting also to kind of think about the economy, since that was such a central part of the early Cold War period, not just, you know, because of the material issues of producing weapons and so on in order to win the Cold War, but also on this ideological level of, you know, capitalism versus communism. And eventually one thing led to another, and this question of all is what came before led me to this topic of how the military was involved in this really surprising way, and that is, you know, helping to formulate economic policy in the, you know, between the mid, I guess the end of World War II and up until the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the short answer to these very big questions.
Mm-hmm. So is this your first book then?
This is my first book, and it comes right out of the dissertation research.
Okay, and have you written articles previously, you know, smaller pieces, or?
Yeah, for sure. On kind of related topics, and then also somewhat kind of giving a hint at what the book was going to be about. And they're all, on this question of really how did the military find itself in this position to be thinking about economic policy? What were the kind of factors that led to this, and what were the consequences of that?
So, let's go into the details of the book then. Can you tell me what you think, what's the book about? More specifically.
Yeah, sure. Right, yeah, no, I guess I teed that up. I sort of have been hinting at this question. So anyway, yeah, the basic thesis of the book is that, at the end of World War II, when the United States military found itself in occupation settings, in other words, as the military government in part of Germany and all of Japan, military men had to devise economic policy. And no one really had prepped them for this. It's not like they had a particular background, and so they kind of struggled to figure out how to actually run a nation's economy. And one of the sort of central parts of the book is the fact that in Germany, the military governor there, a guy named Lucius Clay, ended up turning to civilian helpers, essentially, to kind of devise economic policy, and some from the United States, but also some from occupied Germany. And so increasingly they turn to the non-Nazi German economists that they govern to say, how do we solve the problems facing the German economy? And out of that came kind of a coherent policy. And then the same sort of issues that the military is facing in Germany is facing in Japan and post-war Japan. And so literally people got transferred, and particularly one guy named Joseph Dodge, who was a banker in the United States and had helped out in Germany. He got transferred to Japan and was basically given the task to fix the economy. And he, more or less succeeded there, only to find himself drawn into the Eisenhower administration in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And where Eisenhower himself had some experience in military government at the end of World War II. And then Eisenhower also involved other people who'd been involved in military government. And so the arc of the narrative is essentially this transfer of policy knowledge, first from occupied Germany, then to occupied Japan, back to the United States, so that the middle part of the century, in these kind of critical post-war years, what really happened in these three very important countries in terms of the Cold War alliance is a convergence of economic policy making. And so some of the big arguments of the book are that one of the reasons the world economy grew so quickly, at least the western half of the world, after World War II, is that there was a coherent policy approach across these three domains, that the policies in question were actually fairly successful in providing kind of stability and stable growth, and that there was this network within the military for transferring policy knowledge and around sort of, you could say, the periphery of the Cold War alliance until eventually back to the center of the Cold War alliance.
Now, I did a quick survey of what other people, how other people think about this issue that you wrote about. Did you get deep into the economic theories? There seemed to be competing economic theories. Did you get deeply into those?
Yeah, and that's another one of the main arguments of the book. And this is a little bit, I guess the book is military history, but it's probably a different kind of military history in that, I'm engaging a lot of economic theory. But the dominant theories in the 40s and 50s within the United States and to, maybe even a larger extent, England, all had to do with deficit spending as a way of growing the economy. The term we always use is Keynesian economics. And this is an idea that, started by John Maynard Keynes in the 30s, the cure to depression is to spend. And we hear in this country, this is recent history, right? Under the Obama administration, the solution to the housing bubble burst in 2008 was, TARP, and then the subsequent spending bills were going to spend the economy back into health. And, by contrast, the basic message coming out of the occupation was, that's maybe fine a little bit, but only a little bit. Really, what you want to do is keep the budget in balance. That if you can if you can keep a balanced budget, you can tax high, you have high tax rates, you can spend a lot of money on things like defense or welfare or whatever else you need, but you don't want to do it on borrowed money. Mm-hmm. And the main thing you want to do is always fight even the early signs of inflation so that you can have kind of stability within the system. The stability above all else is what mattered. Now, part of this is that in Germany, the at least early take from people like Lucius Clay that I mentioned before, Joseph Dodge, this banker, or the German economists there who had watched the Nazi experience, they interpreted Keynes within that Nazi experience, and they said, well, this is exactly what we saw in Germany in the 30s, is all this deficit spending to get out of the Depression, mm-hmm. but all it did was create all kinds of huge economic problems down the road. Mm-hmm. And they even had a political take on it, which was, you know, the more you spend and the more you borrow, at some point or another, that leads to something like inflation or a similar kind of disruption in the economy, which is almost always answered by more state controls, more government, you know, price controls or rationing or something like that, which is just another way that helps the totalitarian. And that was kind of the critique that came out of Nazi Germany that military officials in Germany, they picked up on, they absorbed. And so so that you're absolutely right. Your question is dead on. You know, I'm making a strong argument to say, like, the standard narrative about economic policy in the States in the 1950s is exactly backwards, right? That there was no sort of Keynesian consensus in the United States during this period, precisely because the people that dominated the Eisenhower administration in the 50s emerged from this occupation experience that associated Keynesian kinds of approaches with totalitarianism, with Nazism, with the kind of the failed experience that led to World War II.
So let me ask you about literally day one of the occupation of Germany, you know, the day after the surrender, and also Japan when they surrendered. Did the military leadership have some kind of template that said you're going to deal with this stuff that included economic issues, or was it over the governorship, military governorship, did they say, you know what, we're dealing with a lot of economic issues, we're going to have to consolidate and work this out?
Your intuition is right. There were specific policies that were all written out that were supposed to guide occupations in both countries. And a lot of historians have written about how those policies went away. My own take is this, that most of those policies were written very much within the framework of the New Deal. That in a lot of ways, basically, the Roosevelt administration simply superimposed its own understanding of domestic politics on Germany and onto Japan, where the central issue was you can't trust business leaders. They're the problem. And so, in the German context, it was a lot of the policies had to do with cartels. We have to break up the cartels because the cartels are what allowed Nazis to take hold, and it's a concentration of business power that allows for totalitarianism and so on. And in Japan, it was not so much cartels, but family-owned conglomerates called Zaibatsu that were similar in a way to cartels. You know, in terms of their business organization, there was a, you know, kind of a central company that was that would hold lots of other companies in a giant conglomerate, all controlled by this family. And so the initial instructions were all about the you know, basically antitrust policy is what we call it in the United States. You know, take these big monopolies and break them up, or these big trusts and break them up. Because those concentrations of power are economically inefficient, but also politically dangerous. And for the first year, or in Japan especially, several years, that was the policy, you know, that he kept trying to break up these big conglomerates. In Germany, it became obvious really quickly that you could not break up the... It was wasted energy, as it were. You couldn't create an economic revival while simultaneously dismantling the primary structure of all of Germany's business firms. That just wasn't going to produce any kind of economic recovery. And Lucius Clay picked up on that very quickly, and that's part of why he brought in this guy I mentioned, Joseph Dodge, is he wanted someone that had a similar temperament and understanding of how of the organizational problems of running a company. I mean, that was one thing that the military guys, they didn't understand a lot of economic theory, but they did understand organizations and how organizations worked and the kind of chaos you created if you took, if you got rid of all of the organizations that existed without replacing it with something. And I think that was the big problem with the initial orders. It was break up these big companies, but don't have any plan for what's going to follow them. You know, and so anyway, and so very quickly they realized, all right, so if we're not gonna focus on, you know, breaking into companies, then we have to come up with something else. And so starting already by the end of 1945, early 46, Clay was writing his superiors back in D.C. saying, I need different orders. You need to figure out a different way of talking about this. You guys need to figure this out. And if you can't figure it out, you need to let me figure it out. And essentially the word he got back was, I'm paraphrasing, you could kind of ignore these orders that we've given you, and we don't really have a lot of good plans to replace it, so go ahead and ask around as to what the best plan is moving forward. And, you know, and so that's what he did. Things went a little bit more slowly in Japan, partly because the destruction wasn't as complete, partly because the United States wasn't working in coalition with three other occupying powers. And partly because the imperative of getting the economy going again wasn't as strong, because there wasn't this kind of, you know, quite the same sense of competition that if we can't figure out how we get the German part of the experiment going again, and meantime if the Soviets get their part of the German experiment going again, then eventually this whole country is just going to be communist, you know. That sense of, you know, competition didn't exist in Japan, so it took a little bit longer there. You know, and I think, well, let me, I don't mean to over-answer the question, but part of it is also that Clay was, I think, more attuned to what was going on in Germany than MacArthur was attuned to what was going on in Japan. And I think that's part of it, too.
So in your research, did you get a sense of how much they used normal bureaucratic functions to impose, you know, the rules versus how much they had to use, like, military police or military force to make people do what they needed to do?
Yeah, so that's a really great question, and would be, you know, there's probably a lot more that can and should be written about that, even though there are some good books out there, especially on the Japanese side, about the way governance worked. But in general, this was a real a very big problem, and that is, even though in both places the United States had a monopoly of force, it was always elusive on how to bring that to bear, because you know, you can only use the possibility of, you know, getting arrested or dragged before a tribunal or something like that so much. I mean, on some level, the whole problem with governance is, almost immediately there wasn't the manpower in either place to really impose the American will. And again, on some level, there's also this ideological constraint, which was the United States is here to sort of create an order that could be embraced by the Japanese and Germans. And this expectation that the Japanese and Germans would see the superiority of our ways and want to be more American on some level. So that there was a constant problem for both Clay and MacArthur of how much to impose American will, you know, which battles to pick. You know, when to use censorship and when not to use censorship. You know, what things to interfere with and what things not to interfere with. So there's a great book on Germany along these lines, Retreat to Victory, that essentially makes the argument that Clay was particularly good at not using power to impose American will, to sort of retreat, to allow the Germans constantly to take responsibility for their own actions. And in so doing, allowing the occupation to succeed. I think to some extent MacArthur did a similar thing in Japan. Like, he was very reluctant to ever criticize the Japanese. It was almost always complimentary of the progress that the country was making. And tried to remain, I mean, this was part of his strategy, was to be aloof as much as possible so that he could be a symbol that the Japanese could sort of rally towards, more than having to exercise the kind of direct imposition of will that, you know, you normally associate with the military, right, which is all about you know, imposing will, you know, as Clausewitz would say, right? It's politics by sort of violence, destruction, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a few assumptions in this question I'm going to ask, so you can tell me I'm wrong in those, but at what point did this economic support for these conquered nations go from, well, we're going to make them countries that aren't going to attack the U.S. again, to we need to make sure they survive economically so that they can be part of this network that's going to resist communist, the Soviet Union?
Yeah. So, really good question. And again, there's a lot of literature on this question as well. You know, like what's the motivation specifically for reviving these countries? How much did anti-communism work into that? The one thing, the answer to that question is usually it depends a lot on the kind of vantage of the author. So some authors who are very cynical have tended to say it was always about anti-communism and always about making money for the United States, right? It's always about, but the famous phrase is making American capitalism safe all throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some that are more circumspect about it would say the initial interest was it became more about resisting communism over time, and then 1947, about the time of the, you know, roughly speaking, the Marshall Plan, the Truman Doctrine, and these other things, that's about the time the focus in the occupations changed. My own research suggests that the real interest initially was a deep anxiety on the part of the military of how long the American taxpayer would be willing to pick up the bill for keeping the Germans and Japanese alive.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that there's this, and this is again particularly from someone like Lucius Clay, who spent a lot of the 1930s working with Congress as the representative from the Army Corps of Engineers, basically trying to justify the various Corps projects that were going on and so on. He had a real sense of, you know, at a certain point, there's going to be a congressman who's going to say, hey, why are we still paying to keep our former enemies alive? Why are American farmers feeding, you know, our former German or Japanese enemies, something like that?
Hmm.
So that a big part of the motivation was really this sense that we have a short window of support from the domestic economy and from domestic politics.
So do you know, as far as the budget for the Department of Defense, it became the Department of Defense in 1947, right?
Yeah.
And do you know, was it split between, you know, the occupation forces and the rest of the military, or was the budget all kind of just combined together and spent how it needed to be, and resources too?
You're asking a really good question that I'm pretty sure I say the answer to in the book, and now off the top of my head I can't remember exactly what I said, but my memory is that there was actually a fight between the State Department and the Army about which department would have to ask for the money from Congress to supply the occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And that ultimately the military got stuck with the task of including it within its own budget. Mm-hmm. And that this immediately became a problem because Harry Truman set the level of the military budget, you know, increasingly lower because he, you know, well, anyway, it's a long story about domestic politics, but he usually wanted to get savings out of the military to spend on other things. And so the occupation costs tended to crowd out all of the other things that the military wanted at that time. So that was a big part of the story, the military constantly wanting the State Department to take responsibility for the occupations, and the State Department successfully avoiding the responsibility for the occupations, you know, year after year after year. You know, coming out of the war, Eisenhower, already before it had ended, was begging anybody who would listen for the State Department to be in charge and hoping to keep the military away from this, in part because a lot of military leaders thought there is no way we will succeed at this. This is almost for sure going to be a fiasco, and we don't want to get blamed for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really wanted, you know, the military, and this is, I talk about this a lot in the first couple of chapters of the book, and I'm sure you know this and your listeners too. I mean, the military was, after World War One, really politically on the ropes, and even culturally, like, the Army was very small in the 1920s, was prohibited from doing research in basic mechanized warfare. You know, all of these, it was just thought of, it was really a low point, and there was a lot of fear on the part of those guys who had survived the 20s, had risen to leadership in the 40s, that in the 1950s there was a danger of going back to the 20s. And so anything that looked bad for the military, you know, they wanted to avoid. Now, as we know, of course, the Cold War changed all of that and made the military a more or less permanent part of American society in a way it had never been before World War II, but that wasn't the thinking towards the end of World War II and in the first months after World War II. And so, anyway, so yes, this is a long answer to your question, but in the years right after, you know, any way that the military could get the occupations onto somebody else's either budget or area of interest, you know, whatever else, that's what they wanted to do.
This is sort of similar to a previous question I asked, but at what point did the military or the U.S. government think, well, we're going to have enduring bases here in Japan and Germany, so let's make sure we are positioned within a territory that's or a country that's doing well economically? You know, I'm trying to parse, you know, dig deeper into that question. When was it decided, like, we're going to have a strong partner that's going to be a front line against the enemy?
Yeah, okay, so there are a couple of different parts to that question, and it's a good question. So the strategic question, when was it clear that we needed, that Germany and Japan would be the front lines in the fight against communism? Okay, so that, again, the answer is pretty clearly 1947, 48. In that period of time.
Okay.
And that thinking seems to have emerged more quickly in Washington than in the occupations themselves. I think MacArthur always kind of thought, you know, he was always fairly hostile towards communism. Whether he conceived of Japan's strategic role as a perimeter defense against communism, I'm not so sure exactly when that occurred to him. Clay, by contrast, had initially thought of, and Eisenhower too, had both thought of Germany as hopefully being an incubator for understanding and peace. And so they initially went into Germany thinking, if we can get along with the Soviets and really make four-party control of Germany work, this can be the launching point for better relationships with the Soviet Union going forward. So they came around to that idea over time and more slowly. But clearly by 1948, Clay was thinking, no, we can't, you know, Germany is going to be a front line zone. Now the second part of your question about bases is more complicated. And again, there's a strategic answer to the question, but an economic answer as well. And the strategic point is that the bases, And again, you probably know this, your listeners probably know this, the bases were strategic in the sense that they showed a lasting commitment on the part of the United States to the defense of Western Europe and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, and this is obviously why we still have a small number of troops on the border with North Korea, right? And so that if there are ever hostilities, the fact that our troops are there guarantees the United States will get into the war.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done, you know, again, very strategically, but with input from Western Europe. They wanted to know that the United States would not cut and run like it had after World War I, and so that was very important. The interesting economic question about the bases is that the bases became a sort of way to funnel financial aid to Germany and Japan, particularly in the 1950s, in the late 40s and 50s. Because the United States would pay rent on those bases. So we essentially leased those bases. And you could kind of, the leases were sort of worked out in a way so that if Germany needed to, basically just needed American dollars to buy something from the United States, this was a way to get the money to Germany and Japan that the American public could kind of get behind because it was premised on the Cold War, right? It was, oh, well, obviously we have to pay to keep our troops in Germany and Japan. They're defending us from the Soviet horde. So on an economic level, and this was, you know, this was a way to funnel dollars to those countries. And that proved particularly important after World War II because at the end of World War II, the United States had basically all of the industry, we had all of the agriculture, and we had all of the gold. So that, in essence, the other countries around the world had no way to buy the goods that only existed in the United States. And so there's a constant question after World War II of how do we get just dollars? How do we get, you know, some kind of currency that Europeans and Japanese can use to buy from the United States? And bases became a very effective conduit of getting dollars into those economies to be used to buy back American goods.
Yeah, because I was wondering, you know, with the military presence in those countries, how much on-site, you know, manufacturing or services were provided by the locals, you know, to Americans, and in exchange, you know, dollars get put into that country. So I was just curious about that.
No, you're right about that. Yeah. So I don't know the exact numbers, but you're absolutely right about this conduit of U.S. dollars into these countries through all the things you're talking about, and that was a very important part of those early years of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. And your book goes, it covers up to what year do you go, or what range of years do you talk about?
It's got a very broad range, and it breaks down essentially into three parts. The first couple of chapters really are very sweeping and quick stories about the growth of the military and the way the military in the first, you know, starting really with the Spanish-American War, found itself in these situations that you know, where it's governing extra territory. So, but, you know, what I mean by that is territories outside of the United States that are never contemplated as becoming part of the United States.
Hmm.
You know, because the military, even there, all through the 19th century, the army would be involved in something, but it was usually involved in a territory that was ultimately annexed by the country, including the Civil War, where the Union occupied the South for a number of years, but the theory was to help the South become a part of the United States. And so there are all these thorny governance issues that arise when you say we're here but only temporarily, and so we have to figure out a way of making sure that when we leave, the country we leave behind is in decent shape and will be our friend moving forward. And that really started with the occupation of the Philippines. And then subsequently, in the 20th century, you know, explosion is maybe not the right word, but a huge number of different moments when the military found itself in this situation. Right, so Philippines and Panama to protect the canal zone, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, other Guam, other little places. I focus mostly on the Philippines and the Panama Canal because it turns out those are the places where the people who ended up becoming in charge in Japan and Germany had first cut their teeth on this problem, this extraterritorial governance problem. Or in the book, I use the phrase, the external state, a kind of American state outside of America proper.
Mm-hmm.
The middle chapters all focus really closely on the German experience and the Japanese experience. And then the last chapters, I talk about the Eisenhower administration and go all the way up until Eisenhower's farewell address, which hopefully by the time you get to it in the book makes a lot more sense. And he warned about the military-industrial complex. And a lot of people, you know, grab that phrase and focus on, you know, he has this, the unwarranted influence of the military-industrial complex in the halls of Congress and elsewhere. And for a lot of people, that's a prophecy about what the Vietnam War became.
Mm-hmm.
And but his real focus and his real interest in raising the question was goes back to basic economics and budgets.
Mm-hmm.
And his concern was that the military-industrial complex would increasingly demand more and more resources from the American economy, eventually creating a situation where there was constant deficit spending. And then again, the kind of experience that had happened in Germany in the 1930s could, on some level, play itself out in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it turns out, he was wrong on one level, in that the military after Vietnam has tended to shrink relative to the size of the economy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the size of the welfare state has continued to grow, and of course we're all familiar with deficit spending now and the fact that the country is, you know, has an ever-growing level of debt. And
mm-hmm.
and his concern, at least as Eisenhower stated in 1960, was, I guess early 61, was that, eventually this would create a crisis that would debilitate the country. Now, his biggest fear is that it would happen in the midst of the Cold War, and
mm-hmm.
that it would, an economic crisis would discredit the system of capitalism,
mm-hmm.
and allow communism to sort of claim victory on some level.
Right.
As a superior economic system. And so he's wrong about that. Mm-hmm. But some of the concerns I think are still valid, you know, about whether what does happen if you don't pay your bills over a long, sustained period of time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, will it eventually foment a crisis of some kind, and how will that crisis work? And will the result of that crisis ultimately lead to a more free existence or a less free existence?
Okay, I'd like to switch to how you did your research. Can you tell me about the resources you used?
Yeah, sure. The sources are all fairly common amongst people who work in this period. I spent a lot of time in Maryland at the National Archives, and they have the various record groups and it's a vast record group on Japan, mm-hmm. but also on Germany. The University of Maryland itself has a great microfiche copy of documents that you can get hold of as a researcher, and those were incredibly helpful. I got very lucky when I discovered the role of this guy I mentioned, Joseph Dodge, who's this banker,
mm-hmm.
Who came from Detroit and left all of his papers to the Detroit Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a trip I didn't have a lot of faith in when I went to the library. And mm-hmm. when I got there, I was really pleasantly surprised about all that I found, and mostly realized that there's basically this guy out there that nobody really writes about, who was in the middle of everything during, from basically 1945 to 1955, anything that really had to do with the military, economic policy, and so on. And so that was very helpful. And then the various other archives that, people like to take advantage of, the presidential libraries, the Eisenhower Library, the Truman Library, the Roosevelt Library, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all very helpful in trying to piece together this story.
Did you come across any documents that maybe haven't been used much and that you found particularly interesting when you discovered them?
Yeah, in the Dodge Library particularly, I really liked it. And what was really nice is he didn't do it very consistently, but occasionally he kept at least a short-term journal.
Mm-hmm.
And would record conversations and so on. And I think a lot of times it was essentially his letters home, but they amounted to a journal. And there I discovered a lot about the story I told you before about this, the kind of conflict between the orders that had been given to the military government going into the occupation and the immediate realization that those orders just didn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
And Dodge documents a fair amount of that in his this kind of journal setting where he kind of talked a lot about the conversations that he'd had with Lucius Clay and the things that Clay wanted to see done and changed about the policy and how he wanted to implement things.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was very helpful. But, I wonder, and again, I'd be curious to know what some of the other people, because I imagine you ask this question to a lot of the people you interview. And
mm-hmm.
One of the things that's interesting is that when you start to develop a different take on things, some of the documents that everybody's looked at take mm-hmm. on a new meaning, and a good mm-hmm. example for me is that Eisenhower's farewell address,
uh-huh.
which I had always interpreted in one way. And as soon as I kind of got this backstory about political economy and reread the address, I suddenly realized, he's talking about all this stuff about mortgaging our children's future, so we can live large today,
mm-hmm.
and recognize he's drawing on this very different set of concerns than most of us have understood when talking about that document. So I think it's a little of both. You get really lucky and you find a document and you're like, oh, nobody talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
But then that can spur your whole framework for understanding everything else.
Interesting. So what part of the research did you find most enjoyable?
that's a great question.
Uh-huh.
The part when I was done with it.
Yeah.
I will say this. The one thing I mentioned this in the book, the archivists I worked with were all really generous. Mm-hmm. Really helpful at all of the libraries. I never had a bad experience, which is really great. you know, I spent a long time in Abilene, Kansas, which is a lovely town, and you know, and very little. I think that one of the days there, I'm pretty sure we had one of those parades. You know, the town kind of celebrated something. I don't remember what. Mm-hmm. And it was the kind of thing where you sat on the porch as the parade came by, and as it passed, you just jumped in on the back, and then when you got to somebody else's house, they would just go. They'd either join or leave the parade to watch the rest of, you know, that kind of thing. And I'm sure it just ran in a big circle. Mm-hmm. There couldn't be more than 1,000 people in that town.
Yeah.
No, but they were all super lovely people and really nice. I liked, you know, so I really can't complain. It's just, as I'm sure other people have said, it's just a long slog trying to get through all of the documents and trying to think through, okay, now is this relevant? Is this not relevant? Mm-hmm. Have I discovered something that really matters? Or is this just, you know, somebody writing down random thoughts, you know, all of that kind of stuff? It's just a challenge.
Right. So was there a particularly vexing question that you were trying to get an answer to that either you did answer or you didn't answer?
Yeah. No, that's a good, I mean, I think that all of us start hopefully with something like that. And we maybe don't know what it is at first, but it sort of starts to make sense after a while. And the very first question I asked in formulating the project was, I was trying to figure out, everybody seemed to talk about democracy. I was looking at kind of the middle part of the 20th century, 1933, say it in 1960, something like that. And it seemed like every book, every talk, everybody mentioned this word democracy. I couldn't figure out what they meant by it, because it couldn't mean the same thing. It seemed to me like sometimes it was, you know, Roosevelt talking about democracy while talking about some new spending bill. Mm-hmm. Or else it would be Eisenhower talking about democracy when talking about how terrible communism was. And what I suddenly realized is that term became a stand-in for economic policy. And everybody tried to say, you know, I'm talking, you know, they'll talk democracy, but what they really meant was, you know, we need new spending measures to get out of the Depression, or we need to regulate business, or we need to whatever, or in the Cold War, you know, we need to build up the military, or something else, even though, and then I started to think, how did this transition happen? And what I realized was, we didn't have a really good story about 1950s political economy. That most of the things, and you talked about how you did a little homework for the podcast, and you know, there are a lot of theories, you know, in the 1950s kind of floating around, and every time I'd read what was supposedly going on in the 1950s and then started looking at the actual things happening, it just didn't make sense. And so I really struggled with this question of, like, what was actually happening in the 1950s? Where did it come from? And how was it different from what was going on in the 1930s? And those are the big questions that really motivated it. And then I think the really big moment was when I suddenly realized, well, a lot of the people that were making policy in the 1950s had already governed someplace else. They'd already been in charge of a country. And I thought there has to be something from that prior experience that carried over. And, you know, that the more I got into it, the more I realized, okay, so there actually was, and this is what it was. It's this focus that, again, that came up in the Eisenhower's farewell address and was true throughout his presidency, and it was a hallmark of German economic policy during the occupation and Japanese occupation, you know, policy in the Japanese occupation, so this balanced budget, zero inflation, you know, steady growth model. Mm-hmm. And that was a really gratifying moment. I was like, okay, this question did have an answer, and I think I found it.
Huh. So, a question that all this that we're discussing brings to mind is, you know, country or nations have always wanted to have a good economy so that they could spend, you know, a fair amount on their military so they could defend themselves. However, it feels like the stuff we're talking about, the economy, at some point, not necessarily in the U.S., transitioned into becoming part of the industrialized war machine. Like, it wasn't just a way to get a better military because you have more money. It becomes like a part of it, an organic part, a necessary and organic part. Did you see that, or, you know, that shift?
No, you're absolutely right about that. And, I mean, World War I is really that moment I'm sure some people anticipated this beforehand, particularly, you know, in the 1880s and 90s, already it's clear that the Navy is going to be dependent upon industry because ships were increasingly steel, you know, made of steel and powered by coal and then oil and so on. And, you know, but certainly World War One linked the industrial economy to military power in a way that everybody, just about everybody, recognized. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the reasons Eisenhower leapfrogged a lot of people that probably, you know, that were ahead of him in the chain of command at the beginning of World War II is that he had already, you know, he had cut his teeth on exactly that question. He had written a very controversial article about tank warfare in the 1920s that ultimately got him reprimanded, mm-hmm. Because he essentially anticipated what was ultimately, the Germans called Blitzkrieg, this idea of linking tanks, air power, and in this very fast, aggressive way of punching through lines and sort of circling behind them and so on, that would get you out of the problem of trench warfare mm-hmm. that had been such a problem, was unsolvable in World War One. And so as a result, when George Marshall was trying to find people to, that could understand the kind of war the United States found itself in after Pearl Harbor, Eisenhower was someone he wanted. And the other thing that's interesting, just aside, Eisenhower had also spent a lot of time working on the question of industrial conversion, how to take a peacetime economy and very quickly turn it into a wartime economy and devote the industrial power of the nation to winning the war. So I think most everybody recognized the importance of this issue coming out of World War One, mm-hmm. and then a person like Dwight Eisenhower, it turns out, had recognized it and studied it and was actually in a really good position to take advantage of that knowledge start in 1942 and then ultimately when he became president. So, again, and I talk about this a bit in the book, but I think a lot of people who've worked on Eisenhower and the question you're talking about would say, I mean, that was one of the advantages that the American military had, is that there was some recognition, at least by 1942, that this was, that this was the key to success. And again, I know I'm saying stuff and your listeners know, right? Like the simple way of talking about World War II, right, is the United States made the guns and the bullets and everything else that most of the Russians used to defeat the Germans, right? Like that was the real American contribution to the war effort, was its industrial power.
In the book, do you ever touch on any, did the Soviets or the communists ever do any kind of counter economic growth activities? Do you touch on that? Did you find anything like that?
Yeah, so I do not touch very much on that in the book, and that's just, I wish I had if I were a more efficient writer, I would have included stuff about that, but I would, the book was already pretty long, and I wasn't able to talk about that. It's a fascinating question. I did find a lot of really, to me, very interesting material. Right towards the end of the war, some of the American military leaders, when they started talking with their Soviet counterparts, and there was kind of this brief window where there were a lot of exchanges, at least at the top command level, where, the cocktail parties and other things where they're celebrating the victory and they're just asking questions. And it was a really open-ended question what kind of economic system the Soviets would impose upon the East Germans, the Germans in their zone of occupation. And the initial take was the Germans were such terrible people that the communists would never try to give them something so wonderful. Yeah, the Soviets would never try to give them something so wonderful as communism, right? It was like a pearls before the swine kind of situation. And so it was sort of like, we're just going to let them starve themselves out. And now we understand a lot of the animosity that the Soviets felt towards the Germans because of the fighting and so much else that happened on that side. But it was, so initially it wasn't really clear that the Soviets had any plan for any kind of economic system for what was going on in East Germany. Now, the same question you asked me before about at what point did the United States start competing with the Soviets, you could ask, well, at what point did the Soviets start competing with the United States? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that question seems to be roughly the same point in time. Then, like around 47, 48, the thought was, all right, we actually have to help the economy in our zone recover. And so at that point, the Soviets started to implement a, you know, more communism and a more communist approach. But the trick was always that, you know, it was always supposed to be the democratic, the DDR, Deutsche Demokratische Republik. So it's the German Democratic Republic. And so it was supposed to come along through party lines and through open elections and so on. So it's a little tricky, and I don't get into all of the intrigue about, you know, the communist infiltration and how did it work out that the communists kept winning elections and so on, and when did they not and why and so on. But so it took a little bit of time, but eventually this, you know, the same sorts of things were going on in the eastern part of Germany as were happening in the American zone and the British zone and the French zone. Like, that competitive spirit took over, and it was, and Germany became, well, you know, what a lot of us who grew up, you know, I mean, I'm making presumptions, Chris, I don't know when you were born, but if you grew up during the Cold War at all, right, Germany was always kind of this, the point at which the competition, you know, was face to face, right, where you could actually, and I don't know if you have maybe been to Berlin before the wall fell.
No.
But there were these platforms that you could climb, and you could look into East Berlin from the west to see how much worse the economy was, you know, how much smaller the buildings were and how everything was gray and all those things, to sort of demonstrate the power of Western capitalism as opposed to Eastern communism.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that all kind of got started about the same time, roughly speaking, on both sides of the border.
How much did the communist victory in China affect the pace or any of the activities in Japan, if at all?
Yeah, so there's a whole strand of literature that would say that was the critical moment at which Washington policymakers realized that Japan would be the new perimeter of the effort to contain communism. And one strand of that literature says that's why we had a Korean War, because Dean Acheson foolishly did not declare that, you know, perimeter being kind of the 38th parallel, right? So, and that just invited the North to invade. Other strands say that this is the moment at which the United States was eventually committed to the war in Vietnam, because Vietnam was also, you know, kind of one of those perimeters. And so the effort to link the Japanese economy to Southeast Asia and so on became the moment in which the U.S. was embroiled in politics in Southeast Asia and so on. So there's so it's a critical moment in certainly a lot of the D.C. strategic policymaking. I'm not sure that it was as critical to this question of how do we revive the Japanese economy. Because I think things were already struggling. The Japanese economy was pretty clearly struggling at that point. And there had been an election around that same point in which the candidate for prime minister who won was generally perceived as an anti-American candidate. And so there's some evidence to suggest that already in the State Department memos coming back to Washington and within the sort of upper echelons of MacArthur's command, people were raising red flags saying, we need to change course, we need to do something a little bit different to help the Japanese economy. Mm-hmm. And already there was this interest in taking the lessons learned in Germany and applying them to Japan, even before the collapse of, before Chiang Kai-shek fell and China became communist.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope the book will do for readers?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I hope that they're entertained and enlightened, you know, like in a very gentle sense. I hope it's not so painfully boring that, they put it down after 5 pages or 3 pages or whatever. But ultimately, for my colleagues, my fellow history faculty and professors and people who are interested in this topic from the general public, I hope it changes at least a little bit the way we talk about the post-war years, and I hope it also opens up more study to this part of the military experience that usually gets short shrift amongst military historians, and that's the military in a governing role. And, you know, I mentioned this in the book, one of the more recent pieces of sort of command literature, the Army's own training for officers, basically says, you know, if you look at all the things the military has done since the founding of the country, the number of, you know, wars in which there are set-piece battles, and there's a victor, as compared to, you know, that number is much, much smaller than the number of times the military has been asked to do peacekeeping missions, to run occupations, to provide counterinsurgency help, to do all of these things that we have seen a lot more of, really, in our own recent past. And so, I mean, I think that as the military itself starts to recognize it has a much greater role beyond winning wars, you know, in peacekeeping, in nation building, and so on, I hope that the book opens up more history of the military's broader roles in peacekeeping and nation building and so on. So those would be real victories. I'd be very happy if we could sort of change the narrative about economic policy in the middle part of the century, both in the United States and around the globe, and then also open up a venue for further research.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting the book published and how you overcame that?
So I don't know how much this is, how much to go into detail. I was very fortunate in that I had a lot of very good support from the people I worked with in graduate school, in particular my dissertation advisor, a guy named Jim Sparrow, was really helpful in all the kind of mentoring and so on. So in that regard, I had a lot of help. I did run into, I mean, this is, I think, everybody's nightmare scenario. When I first approached the publisher sent the manuscript out for review, and I'm sure other people you've talked to have talked about this process, but right, the review process is anonymous. They don't know who wrote the manuscript. I don't know who's reviewing it. And I only have myself to blame, but I had a terrible, just factual error in the very first sentence of the manuscript, where I said that a particular German city lay outside of Berlin. I know that it doesn't lay outside Berlin. It's outside Frankfurt. It's a whole different other part of the country. I just got it wrong. And for whatever reason, and this happens, I know, to lots of, you know, look, I only have myself to blame, but all I can say is I stared at this manuscript so many times I just couldn't read what I'd written anymore. Right. Anyway, for one of the reviewers, that was it. I mean, he just wrote back and said, you just can't, no self-respecting publishing house could publish a book in which the author doesn't know where the cities are, you know, right, doesn't have basic geography down.
Oh, boy.
And so I have to give a lot of credit. Like, the editor I was working with was like, you know, I don't think that's a fair reading. And so we went and got another review. But when push came to shove, the editor came back and said, you know what, as long as we have that one bad review on the record, I don't think we can publish this. So I had to turn around and find a different publisher. Now, fortunately, again, it was not, that ended up not being a very painful process. You know, I thought about a couple of different publishers, and so, you know, it was really a coin toss between two, and I went with one, and the other was, I felt, I ended up getting published with University of Pennsylvania Press, and that was fantastic, and they were very good to me and really helpful in a lot of ways and so on. But that just goes to show, you know, sometimes that anonymous reviewer can be very generous and will say, oh, you know, silly error, let's try to get at what the real heart of the argument is, because that's easily fixable.
Right.
But I happened to get a reviewer that, you know, couldn't get beyond that error, and I didn't really read too far into the manuscript before, you know, passing judgment. So, yeah, it's, who knows? Like, I don't know. I don't know what to tell anybody else in this situation. You hope you fix all the problems, but you know, you can't account for everything.
Yeah, that's interesting. What's your next writing project?
Well, I think that, that's a great question. I think that I want to do a little bit more work sort of in two directions. You know, you asked me what I hope people take from the book, and I'd like to sort of do a next writing project that talks a little bit more about, you know, political economy in the middle part of the 20th century. And moving forward past the book, I kind of end in 1961 with Eisenhower's farewell address. It'd be interesting to talk about what happened in the 60s and 70s. At the same time, I'd really like to think more about the other thing that I talked about, hopefully coming out of the book, and that is, you know, military occupations, and what is the history of these situations where people who are trained to win wars find themselves having to govern their former enemies, and, you know, there's a lot of history to be told there, in, you know, both big and small, right? Like, I know it's probably too soon to talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, but there are a whole lot of other situations. Vietnam even can be viewed as an occupation in a lot of ways, and to really think about. So I think it'll be good, and I'll try to maybe advance on all fronts at the same time.
So people can find the book on Amazon and, I guess, University of Pennsylvania Press. Do you also have social media or anything, a web page or anything that people can read your stuff?
I do. GrantMadison.net. Mm-hmm. Although for the book, it will just refer you back to Amazon and the University of Pennsylvania Press. So,
okay.
But that is my main social media presence.
And your last name is, so it's Grant, and then Madison is MADSEN.net.
Correct. .net. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Well, that's all I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
Well, first of all, just mostly my gratitude. Thank you so much for having me on your show, and I appreciate all the people who I listen to. I like the people you interview and like what you're up to, and hope people enjoy.
Okay, good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.